Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Stephen Tellis, who's a professor of political science at Johns Hopkins University and a fellow at the New America Foundation. He's the author most recently of The Rise of the Conservative Legal Movement, The Battle for Control of the Law, and before that, Whose Welfare? AFDC and Elite Politics. He's the co-editor of two books, Conservatism in American Political Development and Ethnicity, Social Mobility, and Public Policy, Comparing the U.S. and U.K. Professor Tellis also published articles in The New Statesman, American Prospect, Public Interest, National Affairs, The American Interest, and The Boston Review. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Tellis.
Thank you for having me.
And your article, Kludgeocracy, the American Way of Politics, has certainly gotten a lot of attention. And, of course, on Tuesday, Marilyn Taberner, the head of the agency running the troubled federal government health insurance website, apologized for the problems, promising that they'd be fixed. And, of course, the Republicans beat up on her. And prior to that, you had the contractors last week being actually quite lame, I thought. I think there's a kinder way of putting it. So the subtext, though, as you point out, Stephen Tellis, is that this is a battle over the size of government.
Well, I wouldn't actually say that it's a battle over the size of government. The point I say in the beginning of the paper is that, to some degree, I think the conversation in American politics over the last 30 years has been about the size of government. But up to a point, in some ways, the creation of the Affordable Care Act, I think, is starting to shift the conversation not over to the size of government, but to the character of government. And in some ways, that's really what's being debated now around the rollout of the Affordable Care Act, that it's being presented as if it's a technical question of how do you build a website. But I don't think the really important question, which is the one that's in the background, the question in the background is, why do we have a policy to deliver affordable care to everyone that is so complex that it's created some of these problems with the website?
But the overall point that you make at the beginning of your article is that government action that redistributes resources upward to the wealthy and the organized to the disadvantage of the poor and less organized. And that's been going on. And it does seem that the reason we have this hybrid government-private operation going on here is simply that there was no other political possibility. Single pay, of course, was discussed a lot, but it was never really pushed. Medicare for all, which would be a fairly easy system to implement given the foundations already exists, that was a non-starter. So is this, though, at the heart of the difference between the U.S. and other social democracies, that in other social democracies, you pay your taxes and get your government services? Here in the United States, you don't get a lot of government services. What you do in terms of Social Security, Medicare are under assault. And the conservatives in this country, who seem to dominate our politics, see the government as a form of right-wing welfare, if you will, that takes care of them and their interests. So do we have right-wing welfare in this country?
In some ways, I mean, that's not a bad way to put it, right? That we've got what you get when you have a public that has a desire for government services. And in a way, I think that that doesn't actually distinguish the United States so much from what you call other social democracies. But we have a pervasive skepticism of government, at least direct government. And we've had certainly a conservative movement that in many ways hasn't been able to stop the demand for government. So it's tried to stomp down on supply, which has led all this demand for government to get to emerge in all of these complex Rube Goldberg kind of ways. And I think from the point of view of conservatives, oddly enough, this has not been a very good deal, right? Because they haven't gotten rid of government, but they pushed it into ways that are hard to understand, but that also create lots of vested interests that fight for these policies. That is, as soon as we get the Affordable Care Act going, all those insurance companies that are delivering services through them are going to be a built-in war project for those things. The same thing was true of the Medicare Part D that delivered prescription drugs, right? All of those administration programs are part of a huge coalition for this. So in a way, I think what we've got is we've had a battle over the size of government, and neither side has won. And the consequence is that we've got a complex, badly administered, large welfare state. Whereas in lots of other countries with simpler politics, without separation of powers, somebody would have won and somebody would have lost. But we've had a battle to no resolution that's led to a complicated set of programs that nobody particularly likes.
And again, I'm speaking with Stephen Tellis, who's a professor of political science at Johns Hopkins University and a fellow at the New America Foundation. He's the author most recently of The Rise of the Conservative Legal Movement, The Battle for Control of the Law, and before that, Whose Welfare, AFDC and Elite Politics. And he's the author of the article, Kleptocracy, the American Way of Policy, that's getting a lot of attention. I noticed Paul Krugman mentioned it recently in his New York Times column. And a kludge, of course, is an ill-assorted collection of parts assembled to fulfill a particular purpose, a clumsy but temporary effective solution to a particular fault or problem. The word comes out of the world of computer programming as an inelegant patch put in place. But before we get to the kludgeocracy, what about this idea, though, that so many politicians there is this revolving door where politicians and political appointees and administration officials basically trade in their public service for private gain, and many of them become lobbyists, and it's not particularly frowned upon. It's just the way that Washington works. And then a lot of these, not so much this healthcare situation, but other privatized government services, as we've noticed from the Iraq War, Halliburton, because it was something of a coincidence that the vice president at the time, Dick Cheney, was the former head of that company. They made billions out of that war. And then the other thing that exploded recently was the Edward Snowden revelations that he worked for a private contractor, Booz Allen Hamilton, that got 98% of its money from the federal government. And that company is a bunch of political insiders, and it's in turn owned by the Carlyle Group that was founded by some of the ultimate insiders like Frank Carlucci, and former President George H.W. Bush is also on the board. So is this what we're dealing with here, a kind of cronyism that turns public service into private and personal and corporate gain?
Well, I think it's important to remember that we're not the only country in the world with a revolving door. Japan has an extremely fast-spinning revolving door. In fact, it's called the moment when people move from government service to private firms. I believe in Japan it's called ascending to heaven. This is a thing that happens in lots of advanced countries. But I do think lobbying plays a particularly important role in the story I'm telling, and I didn't put this as much in the article, but there's a great book that's going to be coming out by Lee Drutman soon that basically makes the argument that a lot of changes in the nature of the lobbying enterprise feed into government complexity. One of the reasons for that is that increasingly companies that hire lobbyists want to be able to say, here's exactly how much money these lobbyists are saving us or how much they're actually delivering to the bottom line. And that's leading lobbyists to push for more and more kind of morselized, defined wins for themselves. And that often means that what they need is small, at least in the grand scheme of things, things where they can actually say, here's how we're contributing to the corporate bottom line. And I think that part of lobbying tends to create more and more complexity. The other part, of course, is every time anyone in government tries to do something big, like financial regulation, I think is a good example of that, they have an army of lobbyists on the other side saying, oh, you have to take this into account. You have to take this other thing into account. If you don't do this, then the whole thing will blow up. And there is a case of the revolving door where the people in government increasingly don't have the expertise that the people on the outside do, and that is going to lead them to defer and say, we really should add this other wrinkle. We should add this other level of complexity to deal with all these things that the lobbyists are telling them about. And I think certainly in financial regulation, that's one of the reasons why you got this gargantuan bill, was that the people writing this bill, the bill, were so overwhelmed with the information and the claims of potential apocalypse that the lobbyists were doing, and they did not have the analytical capability to push back. So I think in that way, the revolving door does actually play into complexity.
Well, in the case of Booz Allen Hamilton, which of course is ongoing as the drip, drip, drip of these revelations from Edward Snowden come out, I've talked to a number of former CIA officers who say that within the intelligence world, the morale from the traditional public servants is just incredibly low, and that they feel that our intelligence capability is being degraded at warp speed in spite of the fact that we're spending more and more money on it. We're getting worse and worse and less results. And they attribute this to the poaching of talent. All you have to do is have a secrecy clearance, and then these private contractors will offer you three or four times your salary, as they did with Edward Snowden. And then when you get to these private contractors, because they're private corporations, their real interests are not so much in the traditional national security field, but more in economic intelligence. And that's the subtext for all the anger coming from Angela Merkel and European leaders. They realize that really what's been going on here is the NSA's been stealing corporate secrets. So it looks as if this is a zero-sum game, that the government itself, its talent gets poached and diminished in order to feed these dubious private entities that may not do, that certainly don't appear to do as good a job as the original government entity.
Again, I think the way I would put it is that, and again, the army of contractors does play an important part of the story that I tell. But I think the way that it plays in is that every time you actually, at any one moment, say, oh, well, we're going to do this particular program through a government contractor, or we're going to hire consultants to help us think it through, all of that governing capacity then is present in the private sector, but it's not present in the public sector. So the next time you try and do something, you're dependent on that set of contractors, because the government literally doesn't have the in-house capacity to do things, and it's dependent. You have a situation of asymmetrical information where all the information, all the knowledge is outside of the government, and that makes government in some ways very easy to exploit, but it also then creates a built-in constituency that can lobby to say that the next time we do some program, we should do it through the army of contractors and consultants. So in that sense, I do think this process of people leaving government, going into the contractor world, takes knowledge and information that in other systems would be present in the civil service and then puts it outside of government, and then also creates a kind of a reinforcing loop that leads government to be more and more dependent on these complicated relationships with private entities going forward. So there's a kind of what political scientists call a path-dependent dynamic once you start going down that route, and it's very hard to pull yourself out of it.
But Stephen, tell us, in terms of this meltdown over healthcare.gov, the website that's the portal for the launching of the Affordable Care Act, which is President Obama's main political legacy and his biggest program that's floundering now. He appears to be blindsided. And a lot of the criticism that I'm hearing is that these contractors that were used, the principal one being CGI, a Canadian company that had apparently had some problems before in Ontario that somehow were missed. The criticism you hear is that the government only has a limited number of choices within the Beltway amongst what is often derisively termed Beltway bandits, that they have a limited choice and they choose the best of the worst, in effect. And what a lot of people have said is if this contract had been given to Silicon Valley like Amazon or Facebook or somebody, it would have had a beautiful website and be up and running and wouldn't even be a glimmer of a problem. So do you buy that thesis that it's not so much about government contractors so much as about this pool of people that come in and hang up their shingles in the Beltway? They're kind of capitalist bottom feeders.
I mean, I certainly think there's a capitalist bottom feeder story here, but and I do think there's major problems with how government contracts for IT. That said, I don't want to do anything to get CGI off the hook, but this is an extraordinarily complicated underlying policy design. I think by talking about it as a website, it underestimates how many moving pieces there are in the policy that the website somehow has to deal with, right? So we decided to have a very profound amount of means testing in the exchanges, right? So the first thing that the policy has to do is not just hook you, but it's not like Orbitz, right, which just needs to, get the bids from all the airline companies and then display what the prices are, right? It has to give a different price for various different, you know, kinds of people, right? That's one level of complexity, right? We're not charging the same thing to young people and old people and other kinds of categories. Second, it has to deal with eligibility, which eligibility for any kind of means-tested program is very complicated. And for this one, even more so, because it's based in many cases on estimated income. So when you add all those complexities that are not in the IT, right, they're in the original policy design because we didn't, you know, again, if it was just Medicare, if we just said everybody who's 65 is eligible, right, that's an easy eligibility determination, right? That's not something that's hard to do and to figure out IT-wise, right? But there's so many different complexities in the underlying policy design that it exacerbates any of the problems that you have on the IT side. And again, the other thing is, right, we gave this to the people who are in charge, to parts of government that just are not good at really big, complicated IT things. And also, the expertise isn't internally. And that's the same problem we have with the Defense Department, right? We have people who are doing government contracting on the one side, dealing with much larger entities on the other side who have much more sophistication. So I think this is another example of every time we contract everything out, that also means we don't have internal competence inside government that could be dealing with all these external actors, and that makes it very easy for those external actors to really prey upon the ignorance of the of government actors, even if they're very well-meaning and want to do a good job.
Well, to my mind, one of the most egregious examples of this contracting of where the taxpayer is not getting value for money, and it's directly related to the power of lobbying, is the for-profit college racket, where you have, I think it's up to $30, $60 billion a year or something, comes out of the Education Department's budget, where federal money is used by private entities who just hang up a shingle. If you look at television, every other day there's a new for-profit college announcing with these glossy ads that are paid for by the taxpayer. And the data on these for-profit colleges is appalling. They're attracting kids off the vets off the GI Bill and aspiring minority kids who want to get a good education and a good job. And they saddle them with enormous debts, all of which, of course, is public money, which they then marked up themselves. And then these kids end up with a worthless diploma. And it's a tragedy, and it's all happening right in front of us. And it's a bipartisan train wreck. It's the Democratic and Republican lobbyists for the for-profit college industry. So I just wonder, in the broader sense, is where's the ombudsman? Where's the person that's the advocate for the taxpayer saying, hey, wait a minute, this is our money and we're not getting value for money? In fact, in the case of for-profit colleges, this is almost criminal.
Well, again, I think that one thing to keep in mind is, again, that our system of funding higher education is incredibly complicated. When my wife went to university in Britain, her tuition was free. There was none of these complicated systems for figuring out your income and what school you were going to or anything else, right? The United States has an incredibly Byzantine system of higher education funding, and that, I think, also makes it easy for these, often very shady providers to prey upon the underlying complexity of the system. So I think, you know, part of it, again, is the fact that when you have what I would call sort of pseudo-capitalist enterprises, right? When you before talked about Booz Allen, that basically is a private entity but gets almost all the revenue from the federal government. The same thing is true of these private colleges. And this is an area where I think there's actually an opportunity for some degree of agreement between conservatives and liberals, right? Conservatives have no reason to be defending what are basically pseudo-capitalist enterprises that live only on the revenue they get from government. And liberals have a lot of reasons to be suspicious of them and also suspicious of the way that they often stand in the way of creating simpler, more direct, and in many cases more redistributive policy solutions.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Stephen Tellison.
And thank you for having me on.
Again, I've been speaking with Stephen Tellison, who's a professor of political science at Johns Hopkins University and a fellow at the New America Foundation. He's the author most recently of The Rise of the Conservative Legal Movement, The Battle for Control of the Law, and before that, Whose Welfare, AFDC and Elite Politics. He's also the co-editor of two books, Conservatism and American Political Development and Ethnicity, Social Mobility and Public Policy, Comparing the U.S. and the U.K. And his article that we've been discussing here, Clarjocracy, the American Way of Policy, is available at National Affairs. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about women defying the Saudi authorities by driving cars.